evening, everyone, and welcome to this public lecture offered by Doug Kaiser, who is one of our Shimizu visiting professors. Now, when he's not visiting the LSC, Doug is a Joseph Field Professor of Law at Yale Law School. And I was curious to know who Joseph Field was, so I did some digging around, and there are quite a few of them, so I hope I got the right one. If not, just go with it, okay? Just go with it. Joseph Field is, I think, was the founder of Entercom Communications. Yes, that's the one. And he's got like directorships in a string of public service organizations, including bodies such as the National Association of Broadcasters, the Philadelphia Chamber Music Society, the National Liberty Museum, and my personal favorite, the Settlement Music School. It's very, but he also, probably more pertinently, has a law degree from Yale Law School, which probably explains the endowment of a chair. And as you can hear, he's got an impressive CV, but I have to say it's not as impressive as the CV of the person who currently occupies his chair, because Doug, extremely impressively, graduated with a degree in philosophy from summa cum laude, from Indiana University, and then he moved, or as the verb is more frequently pronounced by people from Indiana, escaped to Massachusetts to take a law degree at Harvard Law School, where he graduated magna cum laude. Now, if you are familiar with Doug's writing, I think you'll see that his training in philosophy still echoes in his legal scholarship, which grapples with some of the most crucial epistemic and ethical challenges that legal regimes confront today. And he's investigated these challenges and tensions between law, epistemology, and ethics in contexts ranging from product liability to risk regulation generally, and notably, of course, in his 2010 book, Regulating from Nowhere, which is a lively critique of cost-benefit analysis and simultaneously also a plea for an alternative representation of regulation as a morally rooted and an emotionally resonant enterprise. Now, with this constellation and scope of interest, I'm sure it won't surprise you that he's also been very interested in writing in the field of climate change research. He's written contributions that address both climate change litigation, looking at mitigation and looking at adaptation. He's focused on transnational governance regimes, and also, and this is the topic that he'll discuss today, he's been looking at litigation as an alternative pathway to establish climate change accountability. So without further ado, I'm going to turn the floor to Doug, who will speak for about 40 minutes, and after that we'll open up to questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that generous introduction. I've never actually had anyone investigate the biography of Joseph Field. He's actually a lovely person, and as you mentioned, a great benefactor of our school. When I was appointed to the Joseph M. Field Professorship, the law school sent out a little press release, and my wife, who's Korean-American, proudly forwarded on to her parents, and her parents had come to America from Korea 30 years ago, but still English is very much a second language for them, and they responded to the press release by saying, "Why is Doug changing his name to Joseph Field?" Let me just begin by saying how grateful I am to be here. It's been such a pleasure to interact with the staff and the students that make this such a very important and special place to study law. I'm also delighted to have the chance to speak to you this evening about the effort to establish legal principles of responsibility regarding climate change. Frustrated with the pace of negotiations in the international political spheres, a growing number of scholars and activists and politicians have increasingly called for resort to courts whether domestic courts or international courts, in order to establish some baseline understanding of what responsibility nations or other actors might have for harms that are caused or exacerbated by human greenhouse gas emissions. Now, in both the domestic and the international versions of these kinds of campaigns, advocates are trying to position climate change as a problem best addressed through principles of law and justice rather than politics and power. They're trying to begin a process whereby reducing the threat of climate change becomes seen as a legal duty of dominant actors rather than just a gesture of charity towards some distant and weak neighbors. In the lecture tonight, I'll offer an assessment of whether and how I think these court-focused campaigns might succeed. I hope to convince you by the end that even though climate change suits are unlikely to succeed on their merits, it's nevertheless important that they be allowed to proceed and that judges address the claims, the arguments presented directly and forthrightly. I should disclose also at the outset that I've been involved on the plaintiff's side to some extent in one domestic and one international version of a climate change litigation campaign. And undoubtedly, I suffer some personal biases because of that involvement. I will try, though, to give my sober, objective assessment of the cases, at least until the Q&A period, at which point I'll reveal myself to be a frothing-at-the-mouth environmentalist who's deeply worried about our atmosphere. Finally, I should also warn you up front that I'm going to focus, in at least in the initial talk, on domestic campaigns that utilize the common law of torts. I think many of the conceptual issues that we'll talk about are similar to those that are posed in international judicial campaigns or campaigns that are relying on other sources of law, like, for instance, the public trust doctrine from property law. But there are important formal and practical differences between among the various campaigns that hopefully we can talk about also during the Q&A period. To date, there have been a small handful of cases in the United States that have presented tort claims against very carefully composed groups of greenhouse gas emitting defendants. And the plaintiffs in these cases have sought compensatory or injunctive relief for harms that are caused or exacerbated by climate change. And similar suits have been contemplated in other jurisdictions, including common law jurisdictions like Australia and Canada. Very recently, the Urgenda Foundation has filed a suit against the Dutch government for failing to adequately address climate change and including in the summons in that case a healthy dose of tort law to go along with invocation of human rights law. So suits like these raise the obvious and I think intriguing question, what might tort law do to address climate change? In my view, regrettably, the answer is not much. Courts are likely to find that nuisance and negligence and other traditional tort theories of responsibility are simply overwhelmed by the magnitude and the complexity of the climate change problem. Tort is built on a paradigm of harm in which actor A wrongfully, directly, and exclusively injures victim B. As such, tort law seems ill-equipped to deal with the causes and impacts of climate change. Diffuse and disparate in origin, lagged and latticed in effect, man-made greenhouse gas emissions are in a sense the paradigmatic anti-tort. They're a problem, a collective action problem, so pervasive, so complicated as to render at once both all of us and none of us responsible. So courts will have ample reason, and not to mention doctrinal weaponry, with which to prevent climate change tort suits from ever getting to a finding of liability. On the other hand, though, what might climate change do to affect tort law? That is, rather than serving to address the impacts of climate change, might tort law itself be impacted by climate change? And the answer, it seems to me, must be yes. The sheer amount of harm that will be caused by climate-related events makes it inevitable that victims will turn to courts for redress. And as with earlier periods of societal evolution in response to suffering that is uncompensated, undeterred, unrationalized, tort law will be forced to reevaluate its basic goals and principles in light of the tragedies before it. After all, when even the most dystopian climate change scenario such as, for instance, the complete erasure of territorial homeland for distinct and long-lived human civilizations, or the rendering of vast swaths of currently inhabited land unsuitable for human existence due to a threat of hyperthermia, when even those dystopian scenarios fail to register as a responsibility of any actor anywhere, then our principles of causal and moral attribution more generally need to be rethought. So what I'll do is focus here in this lecture on each traditional element of tort analysis: duty, breach, causation, harm. And I'll ask how each of those traditional elements might be affected by climate change lawsuits in the coming decades. And I'm going to take these elements in reverse order for two reasons. First, even though the element of harm comes last in the treatises, it comes first in the minds of victims and plaintiffs' lawyers. For tort law, without harm, there's little else to analyze. Second, the element of duty remains the central place in which the common law elucidates the contours and the content of moral responsibilities. And in my view, inadequate concepts of moral responsibility are really at the heart of the climate change problem. So I will save for last that most important element of duty in our discussion of tort law. So, beginning with harm, as tort scholars have demonstrated, there are implicit conceptual dichotomies that are often lurking beneath the surface of tort doctrine, especially with regard to the way we characterize harms. So physical is contrasted with emotional, individual with communal, man-made with natural, immediate with distant, present with future, and so on. And then with varying degrees of subtlety, one side of these pairings is privileged over the other, often on the theory that tort cannot provide redress for all wrongs, and thus some system of triage is necessary. Climate change litigation, I think, may put a strain on this conceptual system by making more visible tort law's disfavored interests. Certain forms of injury that have been rationalized away as incidental or marginal may come to appear more significant when presented in this dramatic new light. Harm can be happening right before our eyes, but we only glimpse it when we begin to think differently. Such a dynamic is already beginning to play out in the common law with respect to ecological resources. Much of property in tort law, particularly in the U.S., has expressed a bias against intact wilderness and in favor of human development of land. But advances in the scientific understanding and the economic monetization of ecosystem services has made the environment more amenable to kind of perception and categorization within traditional common law tests. So courts are beginning to adopt a sensibility toward land that's more ecologically informed, and they're breaking down a traditional dichotomy between development seen as productive and wilderness seen as wasteful or even dangerous. I think climate change lawsuits will further this exercise in judicial education, because the attempt to understand any climate change harm forces judges to think ecologically, systemically, holistically. Courts might also begin to rethink the traditional assumption that risks of future harm do not themselves present an injury that's worthy of present attention. When the U.S. Supreme Court held in a toxic chemical exposure case involving asbestos, when the court held that medical monitoring and fear of exposure enhanced risk theories of responsibility were, quote, comparatively less important than presently realized physical injury, the court was displaying the kind of temporal hierarchy that causes us all more generally to externalize harms onto unknown future victims. We all have sort of short-sighted, optimistic habits of thought that frequently lead us to downplay the significance of future risks of harm in pursuit of current gains. Climate change offers a useful kind of de-biasing opportunity for these habits of thought, because it forces our attention on the extraordinary inertia and risk potential in the climate system. Familiar, steady, linear understandings of time are kind of disrupted when we think about the climate system. Emissions, we know, can be incredibly long-lived and surprisingly potent. Once judges are forced to understand these aspects of the climate change problem, then they might view theories like enhanced risk recovery as a useful device for bringing the future into more focus and attention in the present. After all, by comparison to the climate change problem, a garden variety latency period like that in asbestos seems quite manageable compared to climate change. Finally, on the harm dimension, climate change might prompt a reevaluation of interests that appear along communal or cultural dimensions. Consider what happened in the wake of the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill disaster, a massive oil spill off the coast of Alaska. A class of Alaskan Native indigenous people sought to recover for an irreparable harm to their way of life, which had been deeply intertwined with the natural resources that were damaged by the oil spill. Addressing this claim, a U.S. federal court first noted that the indigenous peoples had already settled their direct economic claims based on the loss of specific fishing resources. The court then went on to wonder what could possibly be meant by cultural damage apart from those tangible losses. To the extent that culture was acknowledged by the court at all, it was understood just to be the basic right of every individual to pursue a life of his choosing in a liberal society. So from that perspective, the Alaska Native tribes failed to satisfy the, quote, special injury requirement that tort law imposes on a private plaintiff in order to recover for a widespread public harm like an oil spill. Well, a conceptual trick was at work in that reasoning. It may be that all Alaskans, whether they are indigenous or not, can pursue the various activities such as fishing that were impaired by the oil spill, and that collectively appear to compose the Native Alaskans' distinct cultural identity. But it's only Native Alaskans who can claim historical continuity with that culture. For all these hundreds of years, it is only Native Alaskans who have been returning the bones of salmon to the waters from which they're caught with gratitude and with hope for next year's harvest. To imagine instead that liberalism's self-made man might somehow fashion himself into the equivalent of a Native Alaskan is to deprive their group of a cultural distinctiveness through what amounts to a kind of hypothetical and omnipresent threat of cultural entry. As the number of lost cultures and languages and homelands mount due to the impacts of climate change, judges might perhaps come to see group claims more charitably. The reality of group-based cultural interests might become more tangible to courts precisely because their disappearance from the world makes their uniqueness, their irreplaceability, more obvious. Next, let us consider causation, which is probably the most significant challenge for climate change claimants. Many climate-related harms, such as those that result from hurricanes and typhoons and heat waves and droughts, invasive species, and so on, many of those harms already have a background rate of occurrence separate and apart from the human warming factor. So under orthodox causation rules, plaintiffs would need to demonstrate that the human warming factor more than doubled the risk of the particular harm occurring that they suffered. Now, that barrier might seem to be insurmountable, but it's actually not. Climate modeling in scientific literatures can, in some cases, enable relatively fine parsing of the background and the human contribution to the risk of an adverse event. So a study in the journal Nature, for instance, estimated that the 2003 European heat wave, which resulted in premature deaths of some 20 to 30,000 people, the scientists estimated that that heat wave was 4 to 10 times more likely to have occurred as a result of the human contribution to global warming. Similar studies have been conducted in recent years for a range of other extreme weather events. Still, a second causation challenge facing plaintiffs has to do with the extraordinary number of greenhouse gas emitters. Any individual defendant can offer what I call the consequentialist alibi. This is the claim by a defendant that its emissions are simply too small of a share of global emissions to have any discernible difference on events. It's only in combinations with billions of other emitters that the anthropogenic greenhouse effect becomes the radical and potentially devastating climatic experiment that we're undertaking. Plaintiff's dream scenario to overcome this multiple defendant problem would be for a court to adopt a presumption that the harm is indivisible and that therefore defendants should be subject to joint and several liability. The problem for plaintiffs with that scenario is that the contributions to the climate problem are actually quite divisible. Although greenhouse gas emissions contribute to a single global phenomenon, we have very well understood metrics and methods for quantifying emissions, for standardizing the warming potential of gases, for tracing any defendant's individual contributions. One study, for instance, concluded that as much as 5% of human CO2 emissions over the last 120 years can be attributed to a single corporate entity and its predecessors. The problem, though, is that once we disaggregate causal contributions in this way, then the problem of diluteness has reappeared. Tellingly, the second restatement of torts in the U.S. offers this caveat regarding the unfairness of imposing liability in this diffuse multiple causation context. How could we find any single defendant with large enough attributable emissions to overcome the perceived unfairness of imposing liability given the de minimis nature of individual contributions? This problem of diluteness would remain even if we somehow assumed that nations could be sued in tort for permitting greenhouse gas activities within their jurisdictions. This is the approach advocated by many who support an international law adjudication of climate-related harms. Historical responsibility for the existing stock of greenhouse gas concentrations, it's a difficult exercise to calculate, but most studies suggest at most around 25% of the current stock is attributable to any single nation. Looking forward, those relative contributions will become more diffuse as China and India and Brazil and other major developing countries continue to expand emissions. So even in a hypothetical scenario in which national actors could be sued as defendants under some international counterpart to tort law, there would still be a problem of causal diluteness. Still, let's assume somehow we get over those hurdles. Let's assume somehow there is a common law tort duty with respect to greenhouse gas emissions. How is that duty breached? Well, one appealing approach, would be per capita emissions allowances. So scientists believe the planet can tolerate some level of annual greenhouse gas emissions without entertaining risks of drastic disruption to life-supporting systems. So the German Advisory Council on Global Change has used this approach, what they call a guardrail approach, to try to estimate the total amount of greenhouse gases that can be emitted between now and the year 2050, while still giving us some reasonable probability of staying at 2 degrees Celsius of overall warming, that amount being what scientists believe we might be able to tolerate without serious impairment of life-supporting systems. So if you take this carbon budget approach and you divide it equally among the world's people, it allows for about 2.7 tons of CO2 equivalent emissions per person on the planet until 2050, and then declining to about 1 ton per person in steady state thereafter. Obviously, enormous assumptions at work here about population size and so on. But the duty of reasonable climate care, at least conceptually, we would fix according to this per capita emissions allowance. Now, to put these guidelines in perspective, consider the following activities, each of which would take about 1 ton from our annual individual emissions budget. Driving a standard passenger vehicle for 9 weeks, consuming household energy in an average single-family home for 4 weeks, flying from London to New York one way. So many of us would be climate change tortfeasors if we adopted this conception of what it means to engage in reasonable climate care. In fact, much of the world's population would currently be characterized as being in violation of the duty of climate care. So obviously this approach is unappealing for plaintiffs because it invites consideration of the plaintiff's own emissions through doctrines like contributory negligence or unclean hands and so on. Instead, plaintiffs want to single out choices and activities of large-scale defendants characterizing those actors as somehow especially significant nodes in what's otherwise a continuous web of relations that ultimately give rise to greenhouse gas emissions. Additionally, plaintiffs want to try to propose a standard of liability that avoids cost-benefit balancing in favor of a simple focus on the severity of the victim's harm. If balancing instead prevails, plaintiffs will have the difficult prospect of demonstrating that the defendant's activities failed a social welfare cost-benefit test. Now, given the stakes involved in that kind of judgment, courts are very well likely to take cues from the political branches in determining what they think the social value of a defendant's activities are. And in that respect, the long-standing tolerance, indeed active, support of greenhouse gas emitting companies or emitting processes seems to be an especially problematic one for plaintiffs. Rather than undertake those kind of daunting social welfare calculations, plaintiffs instead will ask courts just to focus on the severity of the alleged harm. That kind of stricter formulation of duties used to appear in the private nuisance context, especially among jurists who were influenced by a strong classical vision of the sanctity of property rights. To the extent that this kind of strict formulation has much vitality today, it tends to be only in public nuisance cases that are brought by government actors. On the other hand, though, the traditional form of relief in public nuisance cases brought by government actors is injunctive rather than compensatory. So this puts a judge in a very difficult position, faced with both a strict formulation of liability that focuses only on the severity of harm and a presumptive entitlement to injunctive relief. Judges would find themselves inexorably drawn toward shutting down factories, shutting down power plants, shutting down industry and development, and that's not a place that judges want to be drawn. So to thread the needle, plaintiffs have to somehow promote a strict standard of liability, but also seek only compensatory rather than injunctive forms of relief. In the U.S., the best attempt to pass through that narrow needle was a case called Native Village of Kivalina versus ExxonMobil. In this suit, the village of Kivalina, Alaska, and its Eskimo residents, they challenged 24 oil and energy and utility companies, and they sought monetary compensation for the cost of relocating their town. U.S. government agencies had determined that Kivalina has to be relocated imminently on account of increased erosion from permafrost melting and loss of sea ice and other manifestations of climate change. Now, the village of Kivalina is quite a sympathetic plaintiff, one whose constituents are among the most vulnerable people in the world to the impacts of climate change and also among the least responsible for causing it. Moreover, the primary alleged harm in Kivalina, infrastructural damage due to sea ice loss and permafrost erosion, that is very causally attributable to climate change. The empirical demonstration of cause will not be that challenging. Perhaps most critically, I think, plaintiffs in Kivalina, they only seek monetary recovery for relocation costs, and the extent of their claim is already cabined by official government estimates of how much it will cost to move that town. You can see how vulnerable they are with that aerial shot. Notwithstanding these strengths, a federal district court dismissed the Kivalina complaint on justiciability grounds. And critical to the court's conclusion was a belief that the plaintiff's theory of the case would require the court to balance the utility and the benefit of the alleged nuisance. And the court felt that that analysis would inexorably draw it into a political rather than a judicial kind of judgment. But the court misread the plaintiff's complaint. The plaintiff's theory of the case was built on a strict liability conception of nuisance, not a balancing one. Plaintiffs didn't ask for a judicial, quote, determination of what would have been an acceptable limit on the level of greenhouse gases emitted by defendants. That was the way the court put the plaintiff's prayer for relief. Instead, plaintiffs were asking the court to reinscribe a classical conception of property rights in which the interest of the landowner in the use and the enjoyment of the property is protected with stronger sauce than a kind of modern welfarist balancing. After all, if we accept the normative argument that property rights create a sphere of sovereignty within which one can be protected from incursions by majoritarian action, then the Alaska Natives of Kivalina deserve that sovereignty, if any landowner does. I'm not sure whether courts will buy this kind of new green argument for classical liberal property rights. I do think, though, that the climate change problem will bring to the fore a conceptual tension that's always existed in tort law. Throughout the history of tort law, judges have struggled to explain why it is that faultless victims of non-negligent harm should bear a loss rather than the actor who caused that harm. And appeals to the defendant's liberty interests and the value of freedom of action always rang somewhat hollow, given the obvious impairment of those same interests on the part of the plaintiff. Pressed for an account, judges and commentators turned to some nebulous concept of the social good that's said to flow from industrious activity. Often, at least in America, appeals took the form of rather extreme claims about the, quote, barbarism or savage life in a wilderness that apparently would follow if individuals were not free to pursue their activities without fear of strict liability. Such overtly ideological references eventually fell away, but the core rationale for preferring negligence over strict liability remains one of a basic, almost aesthetic preference for society's doers, as this famous quotation from the U.S. jurist Oliver Wendell Holmes attests. I think this aesthetic preference for the doers will be challenged in the climate change era. I think because of climate change, the presumption that activity and industry is on net beneficial to society is becoming less and less tenable with respect at least to some segments of the economy. The long-standing assumption that, as Holmes put it, the public generally profits from individual activity, that may be subjected to intense scrutiny in coming decades. The accumulated debts from that activity will become more and more difficult to ignore. Finally, let us consider the related elements of duty and proximate causation. Unlike more familiar forms of pollution, greenhouse gases don't directly and locally impair human health and ecosystems. Instead, they begin as largely harmless emissions before globally dispersing throughout the atmosphere, warming the planet's surface, and ultimately triggering a laundry list of complex, potentially harmful ripple effects that impact all natural systems. Similarly, the class of climate change defendants includes, in the extreme, anyone whose activities result in net greenhouse gas emissions, which is to say nearly every natural and legal entity on the planet. So problems of remoteness and attenuation don't just describe climate change as a policy problem, they define it as a policy problem. So consider in this respect the familiar framing of environmental harm as a collective action problem. For the better part of 2,000 years, that theoretical lens has influenced and often dominated our understanding of why certain resources are prone to tragic overuse. Unless individual self-interest can somehow be constrained through a mechanism like law or social norms, then the logic of the commons dilemma seems to be inexorable. Burn your barrels of oil while you can, because other nations, other actors are going to do the same. So this consequentialist alibi fails to provide hope and guidance in a warming world. At bottom of the climate change problem is a pessimistic moral imagination. Unable to coordinate behavior through law or shared norms, individuals instead expect the worst from others, and they bring out the worst in themselves. Nations do the same. Afraid to unilaterally incur mitigation costs, they instead lock themselves into an irresolvable game of greenhouse gas chicken. Now, a different sort of moral imagination anticipates instead an upward spiral from acts of leadership and self-sacrifice, one that brings out not the worst, but the best in all. Now, obviously, that hope can be proven wrong, as the realists would repeatedly remind. But there's honor in a sucker's payoff when the stakes are these. As the writer Solzhenitsyn once said, let the lie come into the world, even dominate the world, but not through me. Moral imagination might respond in a second way to the view that individual contributions to the commons dilemma are inconsequential. The theoretical possibility of climate change tipping points helps us to envision the impact of our emissions. If there do exist greenhouse gas thresholds beyond which runaway climate change scenarios may occur, caused, for instance, by a large-scale dieback of the Amazon forest, which is a far, far bigger store of carbon than most of us probably realize, or release of massive stores of methane gas that are kind of secured presently within ice crystal formations at the bottom of the ocean floor, or a melting of the Antarctic or the Greenland ice sheets. If one of those scenarios did eventuate, then individual emitters would have to live with the possibility that their contribution was the one that pushed us over the threshold. Now, of course, it's not that these tipping point scenarios would actually undermine the commons dilemma feature of the problem, but they do help us make tangible the way in which steady contributions matter, even though, from another perspective, they only appear to be proverbial drops in a bucket. Moral imagination also is required to conceive of responsibility in terms that extend beyond presentist and individualistic orientations. So in their essay on climate change and social justice, the prominent U.S. law scholars Eric Posner and Cass Sunstein, they claimed that, quote, standard ideas about justice poorly fit the climate change problem. Well, one response then is to maintain the framework for thinking about justice intact and conclude that climate change simply falls outside of that framework. A different approach is try to build new frameworks of thinking about justice or recover forgotten ones that might be more commensurate with the temporal and the geographic scale of the problem. In this respect, consider the U.S. case of Barasich versus Columbia Gulf Transmission. This is a case in which a class of coastal landowners sued several oil and gas companies for the exploration and the pipeline and the shipping activities that they had conducted over the course of a century that left protective marshland kind of decimated in the Louisiana and Gulf Coast, which then in turn left these property owners more vulnerable to wind and sea surge damage during Hurricane Katrina. These plaintiffs alleged a harm that was quite tightly and directly linked to the defendant's activities, not their activities in promoting greenhouse gas emitting fuels, but rather in carving up the coastal wetland that otherwise would have buffered Louisiana from the most severe impacts of Katrina. Nevertheless, in dismissing the plaintiffs' claims, the court emphasized that tort obligations only apply between, quote, neighbors, which the court construed in quite narrow geographic terms. Now, the judge in Barasich did conclude her opinion by inviting the plaintiffs to replead with a more narrow and carefully constituted class, because, as that judge wrote, by all accounts, coastal erosion is a serious problem in South Louisiana. Now, that equivocation was odd, right? The plaintiff's case was premised on the ecological consequences of oil and gas operations in the Gulf. So if the judge was willing to accept the mechanism by which plaintiff's harm allegedly occurred, then the reach of defendant's responsibility should have been determined by storm surge models, not by abstract judicial principles of neighborliness. The judge seemed willing to find a duty of care with respect to some landowners, but not others. So her ruling, to me at least, represents a kind of half-hearted embrace of the lessons of ecology. The fundamental lesson of ecology is, of course, that everything is connected. We are all neighbors in the environmental sense, whatever our classical legal conceptions might hold. And already certain categories of harm in tort, categories like emotional distress or pure economic loss, they're problematic for tort law because they reveal the way that we're embedded within systems that are capable of spreading wide the harmful consequences of our behavior. Tort tries to manage these conceptual threats by recognizing only particular salient and limited categories of recovery, and by otherwise preserving the liberal fiction that we're all kind of atomistic and isolated from one another, save for occasional physical collisions. Climate change deals a final blow to this legal fiction by making the causation of even physical harm quite independent of collision. indeed of any other familiar understanding of proximity. By comparison to the problem in climate change, the duty that was alleged in this case of Barasich seems non-controversial, even mundane. Law in the 21st century must be preoccupied with the problem of instilling responsibility within complex networks. And the challenge for tort law will be particularly acute because tort law is centrally concerned with the idea that responsibility needs to be confined, not created in the first place. Whatever its appropriateness in earlier times, that narrow interpersonal vision of duty seems to be out of focus in the climate change context, where plaintiff might be a centuries-old Eskimo tribe, where defendant might be a multinational company that ranks above most nations in terms of its economic size. Duty and foreseeability in this context shouldn't just uncritically be carried over from an 18th or a 19th century template. Responsibility may need to be constituted, not limited. One attractive option might be to focus on the instrumental efficacy of large institutional actors, such as corporations or groups of actors like industries. The basic account of agency in tort law remains essentially individualistic, but climate change litigation might force courts to kind of renew their one-time romance with collectivist conceptions of responsibility like enterprise liability and other theories of group responsibility. It might do so simply because the mismatch will be so starkly presented between, on the one hand, our governance needs, and on the other hand, our atomistic and individualistic accounts of agency. Courts in the 21st century might also become increasingly sophisticated in their treatment of what we might call epistemic responsibility. Commentators frequently assume that causal pathways in the climate change context are just too complex and speculative to ground a duty of tort responsibility, at least under conventional approaches. Now, that may or may not be true, but it's certainly mistaken to assume that foreseeability somehow exists independent of defendants or independent of actors with agency. To ask what is foreseeable in order to ground responsibility is to ignore the responsibility of those who influence what is foreseeable. In fact, as the Kivalina plaintiffs noted in their complaint, major oil companies began funding research into climate change as far back as 1970. But then, taking a cue from the tobacco industry, major oil companies shifted instead to a concerted effort to confuse public understanding of climate change and to forestall domestic and international legal action to arrest greenhouse gas emissions. Accordingly, part of the reason that commentators today can claim that science can't trace climate change's causal pathways is that defendants invested in the production of just that kind of scientific doubt. Tort law, I think, eventually will have to reckon with this dynamic, because it will be impossible to maintain the assumption that an independent, objective, comprehensive body of knowledge exists to bring to bear on foreseeability questions. Behaving reasonably under such circumstances can't simply mean conforming to an existing understanding of risk and benefit. Instead, it has to mean relating to uncertainty in a particular way, which tort law might help foster by imposing duties premised on notions like humility and precaution and vigilance. So, to sum up, the winning scenario for climate-related tort suits requires a court to stretch in plaintiff's direction at every stage of the traditional doctrinal analysis. Duty would have to encompass negligence in the air rather than more particular relations of responsibility. Nuisance would have to be interpreted as an absolute protection against invasions rather than a social welfare balancing exercise. Actual cause would have to embrace a modernized probabilistic conception of causation. Extraordinary measures of apportionment would have to be adopted to deal with a multiple defendant problem of unprecedented magnitude. Proximate cause would have to be interpreted so the scope of foreseeable harm tracked projections from climate models that stand at the very forefront of scientific inquiry. And harm would have to be expanded to include anticipatory, cultural, and other forms of injury that courts currently struggle to recognize. judges, I submit, are very unlikely to follow plaintiffs down this gauntlet. Nevertheless, the effort to assess the validity of climate-related tort claims may have significant secondary effects for the common law. Notwithstanding admirable scholarly attempts to encapsulate its essence, tort law doesn't exist in a vacuum as the pure kind of unfolding of some internal intellectual logic. Nor does tort law inevitably and predictably respond to material conditions outside the tort realm. Nor, finally, does tort have a monopoly on the principles and the procedures for redressing and preventing harm. Instead, ideas about the proper form and function of tort law have to continually interact with the raw realities of human suffering and with the other institutions that address such suffering. If scientists are even remotely correct in their assessment of the harms to be expected from climate change, then climate and the suffering it causes will inevitably enter into the common law's evolutionary dynamics. Climate is the ultimate tragedy of the commons. Not only fossil fuel companies, but all human beings, all human enterprises contribute, however marginally, to the problem. So isolating where responsibility for greenhouse gas emissions attaches is an intellectual and moral challenge of the first order. Judges who are faced with climate change tort suits should forthrightly take up that challenge. In fact, rather than counseling against common law adjudication, the complexity, the enormity of the climate problem, I think counsels in favor of adjudication simply in order that some baseline norm of responsibility, whatever its content, will be more clearly specified. With no further delay, public and private actors the world over are embarking on an unprecedented struggle to address greenhouse gas emissions. As they do so, they need baseline understandings of what constitutes reasonable behavior when it comes to emissions. Tort can provide that baseline, even if the baseline understanding is burn those barrels while you can. In so ruling, courts would reveal a gap between the common law's basic ideal of protection from harm and the failure of other actors in the government to step in when the complexity of that harm renders it unsuitable for judicial resolution. The tort system, in that sense, can act as a vital source of information gathering and intra-governmental feedback. Struggling to apply common law principles to the harms of an ever more complex, ever more interconnected world, courts deliver dignified public acknowledgments that legislative and administrative inertia have left our basic ideal of freedom from harm unsatisfied. By doing so, courts also enter into a collective conversation about what actions are called for in response and why. Courts do so by holding up particular problems to the light of deeply rooted values embodied in the common law of tort. So in short, even as climate change suits fail on the merits, they may yet change the air. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we're going to plunge right in and open the floor to questions. Chris?
Great. Chris Hilson from the University of Reading. I very much enjoyed that paper, particularly the way you seem to do that kind of neat reversal, right? So you're saying that most people in tort law say tort law can't really change climate change, but you're saying that climate change might be able to change tort law. So, you know, the reversal's a really nice idea. Albeit, in my view, somewhat optimistic, but in a good way. I just had two thoughts, really. One was what you think the implications of what you're saying would be in terms of knock-on effects on other areas, because obviously changing tort law for climate change is one thing, but, you know, the kinds of changes that you're talking about would have massive implications for all sorts of other areas that would be impacted in terms of tort. So, and you're usually looking at a specialist liability regime, I would guess, when you're talking about those sorts of changes, and you're back in that case to legislatures, basically, because mm-hmm. they normally are the ones that are forced to introduce those kinds of regimes. So I wondered whether, A, you had any thoughts on those kinds of impacts beyond climate change and how you might face up to those. And then my second question really was about insurance. Because insurance is often a backdrop to tort law in so many ways. And I wonder whether you had any thoughts on the role that insurance might play here.
Brooks. Thanks for the questions, and thanks for being here. The reversal feature of the paper, it had a couple of different intellectual goals. One was that I just really like this idea of speculative legal fiction as a genre, like where we try to imagine. It's a little bit like scenario planning, where I'm not making a prediction here that this is actually how the common law of tort will evolve. What I'm trying to say is to the judges who might happen to trip on this article on their way to chambers, this is a realistic, thickly described, internally consistent vision of where tort law could go. And why don't you help us get there, right? But I'm certainly not predicting that we'll actually get there. So I share the assessment that it's optimistic. The second reason for doing the article, though, was that while these cases were live in the United States, they were being attacked by defendants and by legions of amicus brief writers, not on the merits, not on substantive tort law doctrines, but rather with preliminary justiciability notions like plaintiffs don't have standing, this is a political question not amenable to judicial countenance. And I was really, really worried about the knock-on effects of those challenges, because they're quite compelling to a judge in this context when you're faced with climate change, the ultimate, the mother of all collective action problems. You might say, yeah, that feels inherently political. Or, yeah, plaintiff doesn't have standing, because if plaintiff has standing, everybody has standing. But if the judges were drawn to those arguments, then those arguments would be available for every defendant in every tort suit. If we allow because these are administrative law concepts, if we allowed them to creep over into the tort domain, then it would mean that every single tort suit could get bogged down with another layer of procedural maneuvering before a plaintiff ever gets to the point of trying to put her harm before a decision maker. So as a tort romantic, which it's probably obvious I'm a tort romantic, I was really worried about that kind of spillover effect for other tort claimants. But to address your questions, I think the impacts obviously will be felt far, far wider than tort law, and will be much more dramatic than a field like tort law can even begin to kind of gesture toward. I'm trained as a tort lawyer, so that's where I kind of focused my attention in thinking about climate change. But if you ask me as a more kind of personal reflection, I think that the climate change problem poses deep challenges to kind of key features of modernity, and it's going to be something of a reckoning for us all to kind of adjust those key features as we simultaneously kind of reshape built societies to deal with the climate change problem. But beyond that, I've made that's a grand, indefensible claim, and I'm just going to retreat from it to the world of insurance, which is fascinating. The European insurance companies are far, far ahead of the game than U.S. insurance companies in thinking about climate risk, in modeling it, in pricing it, in making it, compounding it into market decision making. And that's what we need. I mean, we need those risks to be priced and compounded into market decision making as part of the kind of structural DNA of the way the market operates. And so beyond saying European insurers are ahead of U.S. insurers, I don't have a lot to add to that one.
Gentleman in the middle there.
Hi, really great talk. My name's Luke. I'm from the University of Sydney. I just wanted to ask a question about the way that we attribute responsibility in complex systems and what that could mean for precedent. Because the problem with complexity, right, is that features are nonlinear and emergent. Yeah. And it is so horribly contingent that in one case it may be prescient for a judge to take the sort of plaintiff's side and go with that. But in another case, that precedent might not hold just by the very structure of the complex system. So if we take the challenge of attributing responsibility in complex systems, which I think we should, I think that also pushes our understanding of the way we think about legal precedent, particularly in tort cases. And I wondered if you had any thoughts on that.
I do have thoughts on that, and you've put the question very nicely. I mean, I do think you're right that there's a way in which, if we take seriously the notion of responsibility within a complex adaptive system, there's a way in which that could be an incredibly oppressive feeling, right? Because, I mean, it might lead us all just to become Jainists and sort of sweep the floor in front of us as we walk, lest we cause harm to the lives that we don't even perceive on the floor. I'm not arguing for that, except to the following extent. So a lot of the foundational environmental laws that the U.S. adopted and then that kind of happily spread throughout the world, they set these audacious goals, like getting rid of all water pollution by the year 1992, or every worker is entitled to a safe workplace, right? The audacious, unattainable goals that from an economic cost-benefit standpoint seem to be naive. But what I liked about the kind of rhetorical structure of those statutes is that by setting the unattainable goal, then as we strive to reach it, we have a moral remainder. We have continuing amounts of pollution or continuing amounts of occupational suffering that have a particular expressive meaning within legal society. They are our failures, right? They are us failing to live up to our ideals, our collectively expressed ideals. Whereas if you look at it as a purely a kind of risk-benefit commensurated thing, then, you know, this is the optimal amount of childhood asthma from air pollution, right? I just don't think it's right to even talk about an optimal amount of asthma from air pollution or an optimal amount of premature mortality. I know that that's not, within welfare economics, that's not what you mean. Optimal doesn't have that kind of moral valence that I'm giving it. But you do have this problem that you no longer have something sort of there facing you as a reminder to try harder, to fail better, right? So the idea, so to take it back to your question, if we took my kind of thicker notion of responsibility seriously within a complex adaptive system, we'd be setting ourselves up for an awful kind of miserable self-loathing feeling, right? But in a way, I think that's what we need, right? There was a continental theorist named Emmanuel Levinas who was a kind of post-Holocaust ethicist who came up with a notion of an unsatisfiable, infinite ethical demand. And his reversal was to say, we don't construct ethics by first starting out as subjects and going and having a social contract with others and, you know, agreeing to certain kinds of responsibility to keep the peace in the kind of classical liberal way of thinking about it. No, his idea was you become a subject by being called into an ethical relation with another that you will always fail. And that other, the other kind of wakens you to consciousness by saying, don't kill me. Don't kill me. But all of us as agents do kill. And so there's this horrible, oppressive tragedy about it. But yeah.
All right, we have a question from Justine over there, and then Joe, you also had one. So we'll first go to Justine and take yours. Let's all the way, throw it over. Or I think you could, you could just.
I just wanted to comment from a practitioner's perspective on how bleak the domestic picture is, but then
to say that actually the work you're doing could be potentially very invaluable in the courts. From the practitioner's perspective, we've just tried to run a public nuisance claim on behalf of 16,000 Nigerians against Shell for an oil spill that had already happened in the Niger Delta. And we ran into significant problems, even on that level of ecological damage, in the courts here because of the group action nature of the claim and the requirement of special damage. maybe there were other reasons for it. Maybe the judge was a bit conservative, but it seemed to me that we needed, critically in court as practitioners, we needed an academic re-examination of the modern development of public nuisance, because all we had was ancient case law, which was totally unsuited to this kind of modern day ecological disaster, and we didn't have that. So hearing you tonight has given me sort of more hope after an abject failure in the courts here. So you know, that's a plea to the academic community to keep on writing about this, because it does help the practitioners. On the more positive note, just as a practitioner, where we're seeing it happening is actually in the public law, to the extent it's happening at all in this country. Challenges to planning permissions are being brought, and people are running climate change arguments, and there's some scant evidence of success, but that is likely to grow. So it's just, again, a bit more of an optimistic picture from the public law perspective. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't know if you want to comment or if you... It's,
I appreciate the comment a lot, yeah.
Thank you. And then we'll move on to Joe. Joe Merkins from the Law Department. Yes. We wouldn't want to deprive you of a microphone, Joe.
Thank you very much for your talk. So I'm a public lawyer, constitutional lawyer, so this question might not be helpful at all. But it seemed to me that you were trying to shoehorn climate change into tort law, right, and asking how can tort law contribute to this problem, but in a way that was kind of it felt like a domestication of a global problem, because tort really is a classic area of law that regulates the behavior between private individuals. So I was thinking, if you weren't looking in the wrong area of law for a solution, and as a public lawyer, I thought I would come up with a public law solution, but it's not totally off the wall, is it? Because the environment is often conceived by international lawyers as a kind of third generation human right type. And so by analogy, with human rights, if a public authority violates my human rights, I don't go after the public authority, I go after the state, right, in international law. And if I go to Strasbourg, where the European Court of Human Rights is, I would be suing my state, not the public authority. And so with environmental disasters of the magnitude you mentioned, why would I be going after those, okay, multinational companies maybe, when I could be going after the state and holding them accountable for failing to, or rather for allowing those companies to proceed? So it becomes a question of national law rather than individual behavior. And it seems to me, well, then, of course, we might need internationally agreed standards, which is going to be probably unachievable. I think you mentioned that. But they could also just be national standards, right? So you don't need that international dimension, but still the state is responsible and accountable for those national levels. That was just a question.
Yeah. No, I think it's a very, very good point. A part of the oddness of my effort to domesticate what seems clearly both an international and more of a public law, human rightsy kind of agenda, part of the reason for it is just the parochial one, that I'm a U.S. academic studying what happens in U.S. courts. And, you know, we're still not sure about the first generation of human rights, let alone second or third generations of human rights. So for our litigants, there's no mechanism like an ECHR for them to kind of try to press this. And so what we do is we fall back on good old-fashioned tort law. I mean, that's the residual locus for the pressing of a grievance that's not being addressed elsewhere. And so tort has this wonderful dog's breakfast kind of quality about it, that if you feel like you're being wronged, you bring it to a judge, and it might be the district judge in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, who's weighing in on whether what essentially amounts to a human rights claim, but couched in this torts terminology.
No, my thought was that you as an academic could develop a new discipline in your spare time.
Okay, well, questions piling up. We will go to the gentleman there on the corner. And also, I did not ask this before, and I should have. If you could just briefly let us know who you are before you start the question. And I should, one person who I just introduced by her first name, and I'll just make this clear now. The question before Joe Merkins came from Justine Thornton, who is both an environmental academic and also an environmental barrister, and her comments from the practitioner side. Okay.
So my name's Fergus Green. I work on climate change policy here at the Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at the LSE. And I also have a legal background as well. So, thanks for a fascinating talk. I think you very eloquently described the enormity of the problem and looked from a legal perspective at the challenge of trying to take on that whole problem through one particular instrument, in this case, the law of tort. And I think sort of by analogy, now working on the policy side as I do, there was once upon a time when people looked for sort of grand solutions through single instruments, be it a global treaty, a global emissions trading scheme, and we sort of know what the first best solutions are. And I think most of us sort of seriously engaged in policy now also, like you, recognise the enormity of the problem. And are looking to break it down into sort of more manageable chunks and achieve more incremental progress that could perhaps coalesce into sort of social tipping points and things. And looking in all different dimensions, one US academic described it as a strategy of dream big, win small. And so in that spirit, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about how you could see the law and private law, or actually even public law as well, but being used in the context of win small strategies that could fit into a larger vision, recognising that it won't all be sort of the law. And I think you touched at the end on sort of epistemic responsibility, and sort of that to me sort of fits in with that. Like, one of the problems we face is sort of lack of transparency of data and of tactics, and that the law can be used to kind of get access to useful materials. It can be useful in the political realm and things like that.
So thanks for the question. It's sad to me that we're not dreaming big and achieving big. Every economist I've ever talked to who's ever looked at the climate problem has said the same thing. We should just put a tax on carbon. And it's just, as someone who normally I'm kind of inclined to think of the economics profession as having this hegemonic influence over policy, and then when it comes to the one place where we need it most, suddenly the poor economists can't get anywhere. But back to tort law, I think one way in which tort law will have a kind of a small but important kind of percolating effect is that I think there'll be a lot of viable tort claims that are based on what's essentially failure to adapt, right? So you sue your landlord, or you sue LSC for failing to, keep the student dorms kind of climate ready, right? And you can imagine failure to build seawalls and failure to have HVAC systems that can withstand heat waves, foreseeable heat waves, all that. And that would be, again, that would be fairly small potatoes in terms of the claim, but it would help with that kind of DNA, structural DNA point that we talked about a moment ago, and with respect to insurance companies. We'd have these entities that are in, managing large pieces of land, thinking about adaptation planning, not just because it's the right thing to do, but because they might be on the hook for liability if they don't. I think that's just kind of one possibility.
All right, Joanna?
Hi, Joanna, also from the Grantham Research Centre on Climate Change. I just wondered if in your paper you also considered cases that are kind of the other side of the story, so not communities or individuals or environmental organizations against oil companies trying to improve a climate law or their situation, but the other side of the story, so companies maybe challenging climate legislation, trying not to avoid that they're enforced. Yeah. So this kind of the other side of the of legal action being used on the other side.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a wonderful resource available on the web from Columbia University, which is the Columbia Climate Law Center run by Michael Girard. And he has a very complicated map of climate change litigation all around the world. Most of it's focused on the U.S., but he's got other jurisdictions represented as well. And it's probably 20-1 industry challenges to climate regulation versus victims trying to promote some notion of judicially imposed responsibility. In the U.S., that's not fair, because the environmental groups will also challenge the regulations as not being strong enough. But so essentially, any administrative climate action in the U.S. is going to be held up in the courts for several years by either side challenging it from the administrative law perspective. And I think that's why partly that's what motivates people to want to turn to tort law, because there's a way in which tort law, it can be a kind of swifter, stronger axe if it does fall, if it ever fell. And tort law has the benefit of mandatory responsiveness. Like, the judge has to give you an answer. Even if the answer is, sorry, plaintiff, you lose, the judge has to give you a reasoned, public, accountable answer. Whereas your parliamentarians and your bureaucrats, they don't have to take your phone calls. I call the Republican senators all the time in the U.S. about climate change, and they never call me back.
Yes, Eugenie?
You said that climate change related. My name is Eugenie. I'm a law student here. Not a practitioner, not yet, maybe.
So you said that climate change related claims should be addressed via tort based mechanisms. And I would like to ask you why you don't consider that it should be treated and dealt with from a human rights perspective. Is it something specific for the US, or is it a general claim?
Yeah. So I want to be clear that I was not saying that tort law is a ideal or even necessarily good mechanism for trying to address the harms brought by climate change. That is not at all what I was trying to say. What I wanted to say is that judges should remain open to the airing of grievances that are related to tort law, related to climate change. Just because I think tort has played this kind of important institutional and expressive role. But other bodies of law, like human rights law, obviously have much to say about climate change and much to say about responsibility for deprivations of human rights that are related to climate change. I'm optimistic about the kind of adjudication that we're starting to see at the international and regional level that links environmental deprivations with human rights deprivations. I'm optimistic about it. I don't study it. I'm not an international law or human rights person, but I've read enough to know that there's a judicial kind of sensibility and kind of ecological consciousness that's emerging at that level, and it's very optimistic.
If there's a slight reprieve in the number of questions bubbling up, I'm going to use my position as chair and make a few observations. In relation to some of the comments that Chris made at the start of the discussion, I was just thinking, this perspective of not so much what can the law do about climate change, but what can climate change do to the law, it's a very interesting shift of focus. And I was just thinking, well, for example, the area that I work in most frequently, in risk regulation, climate change can enormously disrupt every aspect of risk regulation. Pretty much every risk regulation operates on the assumption that we can make reasonable, predictable estimates of what's going to happen in the future. And that necessarily presumes the existence of a relatively stable environment, not only a stable social environment, but also a stable physical environment. And so risk regulation thrives on that. If through climate change and through dramatic changes in external circumstances, it becomes impossible to predict the pathway and the life cycle of a new genetically modified organism is that is introduced into the environment, then that whole regime, that whole regulatory regime, its credibility is completely under threat. And that is the case for GMOs, it's the case for nano, for chemicals. So there are vast swaths of risk regulation that will basically see its their credibility threatened through climate change, which is bleak, but on the other hand also interesting, because maybe we have to think about it from the perspective a bit of, well, you know, who else other than poor and disenfranchised victims, who else is going to start feeling threatened by climate change? And at some point, there are going to be groups in society who have a stronger voice and who are better able to respond. And if that, for example, if regulators start feeling threatened by these consequences, threatened in doing their job, this might be yet another little drop leading to a tipping point. And that actually led me to the second of three observations, which is, I was just thinking about, well, if tort doesn't work for people who've lost their home, for example, for people who've lost their land, if tort doesn't work, then where are these claims going to go? And they might not go anywhere. They might just, and that's, of course, one of the cruelest tragedies of climate change, is that a lot of the negative consequences are going to have to be absorbed by those people who are least equipped to be able to defend themselves. But they're not only going to go to those groups, and they're going to also go to people who will, if they cannot sue private companies for behaving irresponsibly, are going to make claims against the state. And I'm going to say, well, you know, I've lost my land, you have a duty to repatriate me, you have not done enough to build up stronger flood defences, because we have more erratic floods at the moment. So at some point, these climate change impacts are going to make states vulnerable, and that might make states a stronger driver in also trying to reconceptualize private responsibilities, because if it doesn't fall on private shoulders, it will fall increasingly on public shoulders. And then my final, just brief observation is, when you were talking about what courts had to do and how they had to stretch all boundaries of traditional legal reasoning in order to deal with climate change, I'm sure I wasn't the only one who was thinking, like, well, gosh, thank God courts are such trailblazers, you know. Thank God they have such well-established traditions of, you know, looking beyond the parapet and taking leaps into the unknown, which, of course, is not the case. However, I was thinking there are a number of very interesting alternative tribunals that are in the environmental field, like, for example, the water law tribunals in Latin America. And so through the emergence of a more extensive network of transnational governance, you're getting these alternative dispute resolution venues. And those kind of less traditional tribunals might perhaps be more inclined to reconceptualize torts in a way that would make them more productive for climate change. And it's on that last point that I was wondering whether you had any observations.
Yeah, certainly. Thank you. I co-taught a course for a while with the UN ambassador from Palau at a time when Palau was leading a campaign to try to convince the General Assembly in the UN to request an advisory opinion from the ICJ on the question, do nations have any responsibility to avoid substantial contributions to climate-induced harms? And a lot of the time was spent just lawyering the question and making sure it's phrased in just the right way to try to get a coalition within the GA, which, as you know, is the more democratic international body. And there was a lot of momentum building. 30-some-odd nations had at least informally agreed with the ambassador to go forward, including Germany, to their great credit. We had teams of students working and going down to New York, and it was just, there was so much excitement. And then the United States ambassador to the UN, Susan Rice, called in my co-instructor, a fellow named Stuart Beck. And she said, this is the quote, she said, "We realize that for Palau, climate change is an existential issue, but our interests diverge." And it was a kind of chilling, I think, prediction of the world that may come. an increasingly zero-sum, self-interested world in which the appeals to human rights, the appeals by environmental refugees might be kind of viewed very cynically. I certainly don't want us to end on that kind of depressing note. So here's a more positive spin. Speaking recently with Philippe Sands, who of course is kind of the dean of international environmental law, his view was Palau could renew that campaign, but they should not go to the ICJ. They should go to ITLOS, the Law of the Sea Tribunal. Because for whatever reason, there you have a tribunal filled with judges who are not only eager to take cases, but eager to take cases that make news, right? And eager to establish cutting-edge jurisprudence. Now, I don't know enough about international courts to know why that is the case, but it's exciting. And so I'm going to call up my ambassador friend and say, wait, let's get the band back together.
Okay, well, I think that's a wonderful note to close on. Before I thank the speaker, I would like to just say one quick thing. I would like to ask my wonderful LLM students who've shown up here tonight, in spite of the fact that it's in the midst of exam preparation, to please come down after the talk and just introduce yourself and to say good job for showing up. After this, Doug, thank you so much for a really riveting talk. I think you've given us all an enormous amount to think about and carry on with trying to come to terms with this, you know, enormous endeavor of seeking for more glorious ways of failure.